This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capitol Bureau Chief Rick Pluta joins us to discuss jockeying over the state budget and for political position in next year's race for governor. But first,
I believe that there was a substantial inquiry into whether, in fact, the defendant would confess to any of the actions that were engaged in on that date.
Kalamazoo County Circuit Court Judge Alexander Lipsey ruling last week that some of the statements made by accused mass shooter Jason Dalton to police will be kept out of the trial, which is scheduled for June, but others can be presented as evidence. We're going to discuss what can and can't be presented in court with Tanya Krause-Phelan. She's a professor and auxiliary dean of the Western Michigan University Thomas M. Cooley Law School. She worked previously as a criminal defense attorney and a public defender. Thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure. Good morning.
Give us the basic rules here, the guidelines that police operate under. What are they allowed to ask a suspect and when?
Sure. We start at the beginning when police are investigating a crime, and they always want to talk to the suspect if they can. Why? Because, quite frankly, if the suspect is willing to tell what they did and what happened, that is the best account of the alleged criminal conduct. So it's very common for police to want to interview a suspect. When we start getting into substantive rules of law of when police can and cannot interview, surrounds mostly the Miranda versus Arizona opinion. And what that case held is that when police are going to interrogate someone that's in custody, they have to give that individual those four warnings that most of us are all familiar with, if for no other reason we've seen on TV. And it's the right to remain silent, and they're notified that anything they say can and will be used against them in a court of law. And they're informed that they have a right to an attorney during that questioning, and if they can't afford one, one will be appointed at public expense. And one of the issues that came up in this case is that the suspect said he did not want to talk. And there are some rules that go along with a suspect saying they don't want to talk. And the basic thing the police officer has to do at that point is to stop talking to the individual. They have to take a timeout, essentially. And one of two things can happen. The police officer can come back, re-Mirandize the individual, and let the individual make a decision whether they want to continue remaining silent or if whether now they want to talk. The other way that police could get to interrogation after the person had already said they wanted to be quiet is if the suspect changes their mind and says, all right, police, I've changed my mind. I want to talk to you.
Was there also a question in this case about what the police were trying to get at? Because there seemed to be a public safety question. In other words, had all the victims been accounted for at that point?
Right. And that's a great question because there are two exceptions to the Miranda requirements. And one of them is called the public safety exception. And with that exception, if police reasonably believe that the public is in harm's way and that the suspect can answer a question that will help the police make sure that the public is safe, they can forget about giving Miranda. And that's one of the things the prosecution argued in this case. They said, look, we need to find, the police needed to find other victims, if there were other victims out there. And if that's actually what was going on, then the public safety exception would alleviate the police officer's necessity to give those Miranda warnings.
And is this why Judge Lipsey was focusing very much on the idea of whether or not the police in this one particular interview were actually trying to get a confession out of Jason Dalton?
Yes, because if they're trying to get a confession, that's what we call eliciting an incriminating response, as a term of art we use in Miranda law. That's very different from trying to get answers to a question that deals with public safety. So the judge was very correct to try to make a determination as to which type of question law enforcement was actually asking.
And he also focused on two different interviews. The one with the Michigan State Police, at least in Judge Lipsey's mind, was really not up for debate here.
Right, because my understanding is that interview happened later in time. And so at that point, the public safety exception likely is not an issue. And at that point, it was probably a very controlled interview. It was probably Mirandized. And at that point, if all of those T's are crossed and I's are dotted with Miranda, then that statement likely is admissible.
So when a judge is considering here the defense motion to suppress and looking at what police asked and what the defendant in this case may have said, is there a chance here to parse this out? In other words, can you say, well, yes, part of this interview is fine, but maybe this part of the interview didn't quite meet the standards that we need in this court?
It is possible for the judge to do that. Typically, I will say if there's been some type of constitutional violation, whether it's a Miranda violation or whether it's a due process violation, and essentially that just means that the statement was coerced, it was not a voluntary statement, that typically means the whole statement will be out. But sometimes it is possible to parse or cut out portions of a statement that may or may not comply with the law.
The last time we had you on, we were talking about the insanity defense. Jason Dalton had been ruled competent to stand trial, but you explained to us that that doesn't necessarily mean that he cannot plead insanity. They're two different legal questions.
Correct.
So as we look at these statements that Jason Dalton, you know, has been reported that he made to police, certain things, I suppose, could lead someone to think that he did have some mental issues. So can these interviews be taken by the defense and used as perhaps evidence in an insanity defense?
Sure. I mean, when you get to the issue of sanity or insanity, there are all kinds of evidence that the defense can use to support the claim that the defendant was insane at the time of the alleged crime. And how he answered questions, what was stated in those answers to questions, certainly can be a big part of that insanity defense.
So when a defense lawyer then makes this motion to try and suppress statements to police, is there a potential risk in that if everything were to be withheld, these statements to police might not be able to be entered as evidence in an insanity plea?
Gosh, that's a great, great question. And let me take a step back, because as a defense lawyer, you have to provide a zealous defense for your client. And if, as the lawyer, you're looking at these statements that were taken by two separate police departments, and it looks like there's some type of Miranda violation or interrogation law violation, you're duty bound to challenge that in court for your client. However, there are times when challenging some potential impropriety by law enforcement strategically might interfere with your defense. And you've highlighted exactly that strategy conflict that's involved apparently in this case. Now, the portions of the statement that Judge Lipsey ruled are admissible, those are all fair game. Any of the answers that the suspect gave in those statements can be used by the defense for the insanity defense. Now, what raises a really interesting question here is, what about the portion of the statement that was suppressed? Is there anything in there that the defense attorney needs to help support the insanity defense? Well, then that places the defense lawyer in a situation where he or she has to ask themselves, okay, do I try to, even though I got it suppressed, do I need to bring it in for the insanity defense? What would happen at that point is if the lawyer makes that decision, the defense lawyer says, hey, even though I moved to suppress it, the judge agreed with me, I need part of that statement to support the insanity defense. The judge would likely allow the defense to do that, but then the prosecutor can use those statements in impeachment. right? They can use it not necessarily to prove the defendant's guilt, but they can use it for other purposes as well. We call that opening the door, so to speak, in the trial world.
So by making this motion to suppress, it might be, and again, we don't necessarily know the inside legal strategy here, but it might be that the defense attorney is trying to keep options open. One of those options being that that statement's kept out of trial, but again, perhaps coming back and deciding that, well, we're going to have to open that door in order to get these certain statements in.
That's very possible, very possible. And as the defense continues to prepare for trial, assuming that they still go forward with the date that's been set in June, those are decisions that the defense lawyer will consider and talk to the client about and weigh his options based on all of the evidence that's available to him in the case.
The Kalamazoo County Prosecutor Jeff Getting sounded pretty confident last week when this ruling came down that there's lots of other evidence they have on Jason Dalton. So as much as we might focus on the suppressing of or not suppressing of statements made to police, at the end of the day, could it turn out to be that it's just not that important?
Well, you know, from a prosecutor's point of view, just like a police officer investigating a case, as we talked at the beginning of this segment, the prosecutor always loves to be able to present the defendant's own words of guilt because jurors, they like to hear that when they're making a decision whether someone is guilty or not guilty. It really does help them to know that the person admitted to it. So police and prosecutors always love to have a confession. But you raise a really good point. Even if all or portions of the confession are suppressed, it still is possible in any case for a prosecutor to get a conviction as long as they have enough other evidence that will prove the defendant committed the crime beyond a reasonable doubt. So a confession isn't the end-all be-all in the vast majority of cases.
Another thing to note about this case, it is getting a lot of media attention, not just here in Southwest Michigan, but around the country. Probably most trials involving some sort of criminal activity don't get this sort of scrutiny. Does that make the job of the attorneys and the judges, the officers of the court, more difficult, more challenging when faced with people like me who are asking questions about it?
Well, yes and no. I think prosecutors and defense lawyers and police officers are professionals, and hopefully the level of media scrutiny doesn't affect the fact that they need to do their best in every single case. Where it becomes difficult, I think, is once there's a lot of media attention, we have to be concerned about the potential jury members. And how much information have these potential jury members heard? How many of the people who might be called to sit on the jury, for example, are listening to this segment this morning? And so picking a jury becomes a much more complicated and difficult in a case where there's been a lot of media attention. And in fact, I wouldn't be surprised if you see a motion down the road from either or both of the attorneys on the case asking that the voir dire or the jury selection process be conducted in the judges' chambers and one potential jury member at a time.
Tanya Krause-Phelan is a professor and auxiliary dean for the Western Michigan University Thomas M. Cooley School of Law. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. For the entire time that Governor Rick Snyder has been in office, Republicans have held the majority in both the State House and Senate. There have been some differences between the governor and GOP legislative leaders in the past, and now there is some debate over spending priorities, taxes, and proposed new lead rules. Rick Pluta is the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joins us from Lansing. Rick, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Gordon.
So if we're looking at these budget proposals, what the governor's put out, and then what Republicans are sort of countering with, what would we say are probably the key differences?
Well, I think you have to look at it as kind of there are three sides to, you know, this particular debate. And one is the governor, who, you know, submitted a budget proposal. And what we're seeing is the House and the Senate are carving hundreds of millions of dollars out of that, especially in the areas of health and human services and corrections, in order to make way for other priorities that they want. And that's where there's kind of a difference between the House and the Senate. The Senate leadership was very interested in an income tax rollback, you probably remember. And that crashed and burned in part because of the governor's lobbying against it. He said that we can't roll back income taxes without having a plan in place to either reduce spending by a commensurate amount or come up with new revenue. And there were just enough Republicans that he was able to get on board to quash that. So now Republicans in the state House are trying to find as much money as they can in order to justify that tax cut. Now, take it over to the Senate. There's not quite so much consensus there, that some people are looking to carve it out for maybe some kind of infrastructure spending. Some would like their own tax rollback, and some are looking at maybe paying down debt, put Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekoff into that camp. And so there's this push and tug there as to, one, which services are going to get cut by how much in order to do what. And that's the discussions that they're having right now in terms of the budget. Now, next month, there is going to be a key episode in how this will play out. And it goes by the somewhat dry name of Consensus Revenue Estimating Conference. But that's really key, because what happens is the House, the Senate, and the state treasury all come into a room and they listen to some presentations on the budget and look at forecasts of things like housing starts and auto sales. And from that, they derive a revenue number. And if that number is bigger than what it is right now, then they have more money to work with in the budget for everyone's priorities or whatever it is that they settle on. If it's less, then they're going to have to adjust the budget downward. And, you know, then the challenge becomes that much greater.
So as I mentioned at the beginning, there have been some differences between the governor and Republican legislative leaders in the past on things like Medicaid expansion.
Medicaid expansion was a big one.
Road funding.
International Bridge in Detroit, how much money to put into roads. Yeah, all of those.
So does this in any way feel different, in part because of what you said about how, if you look at this, it really is kind of a three-sided debate? You've got the governor, the Senate, and the House. Does this make the dynamic a little different this time around?
You know, the governor put it pretty well last week when he said, you know, every budget season is different, but every budget season is also similar in that there are competing priorities and they've got to sit down and resolve them. And I think that was a pretty good way to put it. They're going to come up with something. And one thing that this group is very, very proud of is that they've always gotten the budget done in early June, which was one of the new aspects of, you know, the Snyder administration and Republican hegemony in Lansing, that the state's fiscal year begins on October 1st. And typically getting the budget wrapped up would go almost right up until then. I think before Rick Snyder took office, the earliest I'd seen it done in my time in Lansing was sometime in July. And the problem is that October 1st, beginning of the fiscal year, is problematic for schools, for community colleges, for universities, for local governments, all of which have a stake in the state budget. And they have fiscal years that start on July 1st. So that means that historically, what's been typical is that all of those entities are starting their budget years using their best guess on what they're going to get from Lansing. So, you know, one of the innovations of the Snyder administration was getting it done in early June to, you know, give these institutions some certainty in terms of their own budgets vis-a-vis what they're getting from the state. They're really proud of that, and they're not going to jeopardize that for, you know, over this argument. there was some talk of it, but I think that that was quashed pretty quickly because that would just make Republicans all look bad.
So the governor and Republicans in the Senate in particular are also at a difference here over new lead rules for the state. The governor seems to want these and the Senate's not moving very quickly on them. What's the difference there?
Well, this is both the House and the Senate that you'll remember that the governor says that the federal lead and copper rule, as it's administered by the EPA, he's called it, you know, dumb and confusing. And he said, since the EPA is foot dragging on updating the lead and copper rule, then the state should enact one, and he wants it to be the strictest one in the country. Well, that would also mean stricter than the federal guidelines, and Republicans in the House and the Senate have a philosophical objection to that. As a matter of fact, there is a bill in the legislature that says that would say, if it's adopted, that if a state agency wants to adopt a rule that is stricter than what the federal government has, they have to jump through some extra hoops to justify that. And that under most circumstances, the state rule should be no stricter than the federal rule. So he's running into a philosophical disagreement about that. And what they're doing is right now they're trying to check and see, well, how far can the state go in adopting its own rules regarding lead in drinking water without having to go to the legislature for approval and see how far they can, how far they can take it. And then just try to lobby the legislature to do the rest of the job.
The Detroit News and Free Press both had stories last week on what they termed a rather slow start to the legislative session. They noted that there's been 20-some-odd bills signed into law, most of them in Kalamazoo when Governor Rick Snyder was signing the criminal justice
reform. The corrections overhaul, yeah.
Yeah, into law. And that's most of the work that's been done. Now, you've viewed this for a long time. Does this look like an unusually unproductive beginning to the session to you, especially considering the dynamics here, that you do have Republican control of the governor's office and the House and Senate?
I think it would be fair to say that there's been kind of an anemic start to this legislative session, although there are certainly, some libertarian-leaning conservatives who would argue that the less the legislature does, the better, unless they're actually rolling back regulations. But it is kind of a slow start, and I think a lot of that was because of the early standoff over the income tax rollback. House leaders put that up for a vote. They couldn't even get enough out of their own Republican caucus to get that adopted. The Senate was not on board. The governor was not on board. That was their number one priority. A lot of people questioned why they even put it up for adoption if they weren't sure they had the votes. And I think that kind of just stalled a lot of things, that, Republican leaders are kind of moving the pieces around to see, what they can do before they go back and visit that particular controversy.
So speaking of intra-party debates, this, of course, is the last couple years that Governor Rick Snyder will be in office. He can't run for re-election again because of the term limits law in Michigan. So everyone is gearing up, both Republicans and Democrats, for 2018. Specifically on the Republican side, what do we see in terms of the candidates who are looking to succeed Rick Snyder?
Well, no one has officially announced, but we are seeing sort of those, machinations occurring. This is the period that I call the silent campaign, when most of the attention is on gathering the structures of a campaign and meeting with strategists, meeting with opinion leaders, with donors and potential donors to try and set up the beginnings of a campaign so that when the time comes, you're ready to launch. But we're seeing lots of signals on the Republican side as to what is going on. If you look, for example, just at the public calendar that's put out by the Snyder administration, day after day after day, you see Brian Kelly, the lieutenant governor, at events. Brian Kelly, really getting out there a lot more than the governor. And Rick Snyder is also, you know, doing a lot to put his lieutenant governor in the spotlight. He, you know, talks about all the assignments that Brian Kelly has had in terms of leading the state's effort on addressing opioid addiction, the Flint water crisis. Brian Kelly is instrumental in a lot of negotiations with the legislature. There was an event last week at the state capitol. It was the 100th birthday of the Michigan State Police. And Rick Snyder made sure that Brian Kelly was sitting right up there alongside with him, and this is how he was introduced.
We happen to have the finest lieutenant governor in the country, and he's been of great service in so many things, from helping improve our business climate to helping our human services and taking care of people in need. So it's with great honor I have a chance to introduce my partner, Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly.
And that's just very typical of, you know, what we see from the administration as they, you know, try and set up Brian Kelly for, you know, a run for governor and, you know, arguably kind of a Snyder administration third term. So like I just said, you know, no one has officially announced yet, although, you know, Brian Kelly already behaving an awful lot like a candidate. And Bill Schuette also showed up at this 100th birthday celebration for the state police. And
Bill Schuette widely expected to run for governor in 2018 as well.
And he dropped this little hint as to as far as his future plans.
Now, in 1917, the attorney general was a guy named Alexander Grosbeck. So put that in your trivial pursuit file, all right?
So Alexander Grosbeck in 1917, it is true, was the state's Republican attorney general who the following year, 1918, ran for and won the office of governor. So that was Bill Schuette showing up and sort of, you know, playfully dropping his own little markers to what his future plans might be.
So Alexander Grosbeck is one example, and off the top of my head, I can think of at least one other attorney general who became governor, Jennifer Granholm.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's considered, you know, we haven't had that tradition in Michigan very long because Granholm's predecessor as attorney general, Frank Kelly, had served in the office so long, it had sort of ceased to be a launching pad for, you know, people wanting to go to, for politicians wanting to go to the next step. And now we're kind of seeing a restoration of that pattern.
What about going from lieutenant governor to governor?
Not nearly as a good a record. That you'll remember that Jennifer Granholm's Lieutenant Governor John Cherry started to get into the race, saw that winning was not in the cards, and he withdrew. John Engler's Lieutenant Governor Dick Postumus ran and lost to Jennifer Granholm. The last Lieutenant Governor to step into the governor's job was William Milliken, and he got a head start because he assumed the office when Governor George Romney joined the Richard Nixon cabinet. So it for whatever reasons, it seems to be a lot harder for a lieutenant governor to successfully seek the seat than an attorney general. And there are a lot of reasons for that. Incumbent fatigue would be, you know, one of the biggest ones, is that it's kind of typical that after 8 years of, you know, one particular office holder, that people are looking for a change there. But, you know, that also would create a challenge for Bill Schuette if he were the nominee as well, because, you know, is it incumbent fatigue or will it be Republican fatigue after 8 years of Rick Snyder?
And I guess we've got a year and a half or so to figure all that out.
Oh, it's going to be fascinating to watch just how, you know, all these pieces are moving around and how people, you know, position themselves vis-a-vis their adversaries or their potential adversaries. I've been covering Lansing for 30 years, and it's just always the way that it's been.
Rick Pluta, as always, thank you for your time.
Always a pleasure, Gordon.
Rick Pluta is the Michigan Public Radio Network's Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us from Lansing. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.